After walking back from the village to his manor across the dimming snows, Slepsov sat down in a corner on a plush-covered chair which he never remembered using before. It was the kind of thing that happens after some great calamity. Not your brother, but a chance acquaintance, a vague country neighbor to whom you never paid much attention, with whom in normal times you exchange scarcely a word, is the one who comforts you wisely and gently, and hands you your dropped hat after the funeral service is over, and you are reeling from grief, your teeth chattering, your eyes blinded by tears. The same can be said of inanimate objects. Any room, even the coziest and the most absurdly small, in the little used wing of a great country house, has an unlived-in corner. And it was such a corner in which Slepsov sat. The wing was connected by a wooden gallery, now encumbered with our huge North Russian snowdrifts, to the master house, used only in summer. There was no need to awaken it, to heat it. The master had come from Petersburg for only a couple of days, and had settled in the annex, where it was a simple matter to get the stoves of white Dutch tile going. The master sat in his corner, on that plush chair, as in a doctor's waiting room. The room floated in darkness. Ivan, the quiet, portly valet, who had recently shaved off his moustache and now looked like his late father, the family butler, brought in a kerosene lamp, all trimmed and brimming with light. He set it on a small table and noiselessly caged it within its pink silk shade. For an instant, a tilted mirror reflected his lit ear and cropped grey hair. Then he withdrew, and the door gave a subdued creak. Slepsov raised his hand from his knee and slowly examined it. A drop of candle wax had stuck and hardened in the thin fold of skin between two fingers. He spread his fingers, and the little white scale cracked. The following morning, after a night spent in nonsensical fragmentary dreams totally unrelated to his grief, Slepsov stepped out into the cold veranda. The outer door resisted at first, then opened with a luscious crunch, and the dazzling frost hit his face. Slepsov strode off slowly along a straight path, the only one cleared of snow, into that blinding, distant landscape. He was amazed to be still alive, and able to perceive the brilliance of the snow and feel his front teeth ache from the cold. A little farther, the supports of a footbridge stuck out of the snow, and there Slepsov stopped. Bitterly, angrily, he pushed the thick, fluffy covering off the parapet. He vividly recalled how this bridge looked in summer. There was his son walking along the slippery planks, and deftly plucking off with his net a butterfly that had settled on the railing. Now the boy sees his father. Forever lost laughter plays on his face, under the turned-down brim of a straw hat burned dark by the sun. His hand toys with the chainlet of the leather purse attached to his belt, his dear, smooth, suntanned legs in their serge shorts and soaked sandals assume their usual cheerful, widespread stance. Just recently, in Petersburg, after having babbled in his delirium about school, about his bicycle, about some great oriental moth, he died. And yesterday, Slepsov had taken the coffin, weighted down, it seemed, with an entire lifetime, to the country, into the family vault near the village church. That was where he headed after lunch, in an old sleigh with a high, straight back. When he arrived, he sat for an hour or so by the grave, resting a heavy woolen-gloved hand on the iron of the railing that burned his hand through the wool. He came home with a slight sense of disappointment, as if there, in the buried vault, he had been even further removed from his son than here, where the countless summer tracks of his rapid sandals were preserved beneath the snow. In the evening, overcome by a fit of intense sadness, he had the main house unlocked. When the door swung open with a weighty wail, and a whiff of special and wintry coolness came from the sonorous iron-barred vestibule, Slepsov took the lamp with its tin reflector from the watchman's hand, and entered the house alone. The parquet floors crackled eerily under his step. room after room filled with yellow light, and the shrouded furniture seemed unfamiliar. Instead of a tinkling chandelier, a soundless bag hung from the ceiling, and Slepsov's enormous shadow, slowly extending one arm, floated across the wall and over the grey squares of curtained paintings. He went into the room which had been his son's study in summer, set the lamp on the window ledge, and, breaking his fingernails as he did so, opened the folding shutters, even though all was darkness outside. He sat down at the bare desk, and sternly, from under bent brows, examined the pale wallpaper with its garlands of bluish roses. A narrow office-like cabinet with sliding drawers from top to bottom, the couch and armchairs under slipcovers. And suddenly, dropping his head onto the desk, he started to shake, passionately, noisily, pressing first his lips, then his wet cheek to the cold, dusty wood, and clutching at its far corners. In the desk he found a notebook, spreading boards, supplies of black pins, and an English biscuit tin that contained a large exotic cocoon which had cost 3 rubles. It was papery to the touch and seemed made of a brown folded leaf. His son had remembered it during his sickness, regretting that he had left it behind, but consoling himself with the thought that the chrysalid inside was probably dead. He also found a torn net, a tarlatan bag on a collapsible hoop, and the muslin still smelled of summer and sun-hot grass. Then, bending lower and lower and sobbing with his whole body, he began pulling out one by one the glass-topped drawers of the cabinet. In the dim lamplight, the even files of specimens shone silk-like under the glass. Here, in this room, on that very desk, his son had spread the wings of his captures. He would first pin the carefully killed insect in the cork-bottom groove of the setting board, between the adjustable strips of wood, and fasten down flat with pinned strips of paper the still fresh, soft wings. They had now dried long ago, and been transferred to the cabinet. Those spectacular swallowtails, those dazzling coppers and blues, and the various fritillaries, some mounted in a supine position to display the mother-of-pearl undersides. And the moths. The moths. The first aspen hawk of 5 summers ago. The night was smoke blue and moonlit. Thin clouds were scattered about the sky, but did not touch the delicate, icy moon. In the plush-upholstered, well-heated room of the annex, Ivan had placed a 2-foot fir tree in a clay pot on the table, and was just attaching a candle to its cruciform tip, when Slepsov returned from the main house, chilled, red-eyed, with grey dust smears on his cheek, carrying a wooden case under his arm. Seeing the Christmas tree on the table, he asked absently, "What's that?" Relieving him of the case, Ivan answered in a low, mellow voice, "There's a holiday coming up tomorrow." "No, take it away," said Slepsov with a frown, while thinking, "Can this be Christmas Eve? How could I have forgotten?" Ivan gently insisted, "It's nice and green. Let it stand for a while." "Please take it away," repeated Slepsov, and bent over the case he had brought. In it he had gathered his son's belongings, the folding butterfly net, the biscuit tin with the pear-shaped cocoon, the spreading board, the pins in their lacquered box, the blue notebook. Half of the first page had been torn out, and its remaining fragment contained part of a French dictation. There followed daily entries, names of captured butterflies, and other notes. Walked across the bog as far as Borovichi. Raining today, played checkers with father, then read Goncharov's Frigate, a deadly bore. Marvelous hot day, rode my bike in the evening, a midge got in my eye. Deliberately rode by her dacha twice, but didn't see her. Slepsov raised his head, swallowed something hot and huge. Of whom was his son writing? "Rode my bike as usual," he read on. "Our eyes nearly met. My darling, my love." "This is unthinkable," whispered Slepsov. "I'll never know." He bent over again, avidly deciphering the childish handwriting that slanted up, then curved down in the margin. Saw a fresh specimen of the Camberwell beauty today. That means autumn is here. Rain in the evening. She has probably left, and we didn't even get acquainted. Farewell, my darling. I feel terribly sad. He never said anything to me. Slepsov got up. He shook his head, restraining yet another onrush of hideous sobs. I can't bear it any longer. It's Christmas tomorrow, and I'm going to die. Of course. It's so simple. This very night. He pulled out a handkerchief and dried his eyes, his beard, his cheeks. Dark streaks remained on the handkerchief. Death, Slepsov said softly, as if concluding a long sentence. The clock ticked. Frost patterns overlapped on the blue glass of the window. The open notebook shone radiantly on the table. Next to it, the light went through the muslin of the butterfly net and glistened on a corner of the open tin. Slepsov pressed his eyes shut and had a fleeting sensation that earthly life lay before him, totally bared and comprehensible, and ghastly in its sadness, humiliatingly pointless, sterile, devoid of miracles. At that instant, there was a sudden snap. A thin sound like that of an overstretched rubber band breaking. Slepsov opened his eyes. The cocoon in the biscuit tin had burst at its tip, and a black, wrinkled creature the size of a mouse was crawling up the wall above the table. It stopped, holding onto the surface with six black furry feet, and started palpitating strangely. It had emerged from the chrysalid because a man overcome with grief had transferred a tin box to his warm room, and the warmth had penetrated its taut leaf and silk envelope. It had awaited this moment so long, had collected its strength so tensely, and now, having broken out, it was slowly and miraculously expanding. Gradually, the wrinkled tissues, the velvety fringes unfurled. The fan-pleated veins grew firmer as they filled with air. It became a winged thing imperceptibly, as a maturing face imperceptibly becomes beautiful. And its wings, still feeble, still moist, kept growing and unfolding, and now they were developed to the limit set for them by God. And there, on the wall, instead of a little lump of life, instead of a dark mouse, was a great Atticus moth like those that fly bird-like around lamps in the Indian dusk. And then those thick black wings, with a glazy eye spot on each and a purplish bloom dusting their hooked foretips, took a full breath under the impulse of tender, ravishing, almost human happiness.
Robert Glenister was reading Christmas by Vladimir Nabokov. The producer was Gaynor McFarland.